The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, welcome to this edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up on today's program, it's been at a crisis level for years in the U.S., opioid-related overdoses.
You know, nobody prepares you for what to do when your child's struggling with addiction.
When people are little kids, they do not sit and say, I want to grow up to be an alcoholic or an addict. They don't. People never know when it's going to hit them. A lot of times they find out with that first hit that they take.
Well, recently the FDA approved Narcan for over-the-counter sales. It reverses an opioid overdose. Now, we'll talk to a local organization that's already distributing this life-saving drug, and you'll hear how. Also, Families First started as an orphanage on the west side of the city. CEO Paula Moody talks about how the 100-year-old-plus organization continues to help families in so many ways. All that's just ahead, but first, a check of this news. As much of the news cycle Tuesday centered on former President Donald Trump as he made an appearance in a Manhattan courtroom, Trump is still the center of an investigation here in Fulton County that deals with whether or not Trump attempted to overturn the 2020 presidential election results. We'll hear more from WABE's Sam Greenglass.
Fulton County District Attorney Fonnie Willis has been weighing whether to ask a grand jury to indict Trump and others for their actions after the 2020 election, including pressuring election officials to find him votes. Prosecutors in New York, meanwhile, are zeroing in on a hush money payment made during the 2016 campaign to conceal a fling with an adult film actress. In recent days, the former president's lawyers have tried to style the several Trump-focused criminal investigations as one and the same. Attorney Jim Trustee spoke with NPR on Friday.
Everywhere you look, when it comes to the FBI conduct, DOJ conduct, Georgia, New York, you have prosecutors and investigators that break the rules to go after President Trump.
Trustee didn't cite any specific evidence of that. In New York, Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene appeared at a rally outside the courthouse. Her short remarks were mostly drowned out by anti-Trump protesters. But this is what Greene told a pro-Trump media outlet on the way in.
President Trump is joining some of the most incredible people in history being arrested today. Nelson Mandela was arrested, served time in prison. Jesus was arrested.
Whether Trump will be indicted soon in Georgia for interfering with the election is still unknown. In Fulton County, a grand jury meets on Mondays and Tuesdays. Another convenes Thursdays and Fridays. Sam Greenglass, WABE News.
In other news, Governor Brian Kemp has made the first veto of his second term. Kemp nixed a bill that would have required the legislature to approve any annual tuition increases within a University of Georgia system above 3%. The governor says Georgia's constitution gives power over the university system to the Board of Regents, and giving the legislature power to block tuition increases would require voters approving a constitutional amendment. Supporters of the bill had said they wanted to help keep tuition low. Next year's state budget includes a $66 million budget cut with the University of Georgia system. Democrat Stacey Abrams is not quite out of the political sphere. She's just been named the inaugural chair for race and black politics at Howard University. HU, you know. The school's president, Wayne A.I. Frederick, says Abrams' appointment expands on the legacy of renowned political strategist and scholar Dr. Ronald Walters by bringing Howard students in dialogue with what he says is a contemporary candidate whose work has directly influenced today's political landscape. In her new role, Abrams will reportedly foster collaborations on issues regarding race and black politics, as well as inspire research and encourage discussions on real-world solutions to complex issues. Abrams says, quote, "We are at an inflection point for American and international democracy, and I look forward to engaging Howard University's extraordinary students in a conversation about where they can influence, shape, and direct the critical public policy decisions we face," close quote. Inspections of private military housing are set to start next week at Georgia's Fort Gordon. That's after revelations that issues in some homes weren't being fixed by private companies operating the communities. Emily Wu Pearson has more.
For at least 10 years, military families living in private housing at Fort Gordon near Augusta reported issues that caused illness, including leaking roofs and mold growth in multiple properties. In an 8-month Senate investigation, the same issues were found in private military housing administered by Balfour BD communities across the country. Balfour had already pleaded guilty to committing fraud in its military housing from 2013 to 2019. While the U.S. Army did not find indications of fraud this time, it says the company did mistreat military families. These inspections will be the first of private military housing in the nation. Emily Wu Pearson, WABE News.
The DeKalb County Board of Education has narrowed down the field to a sole finalist to be its next superintendent. Dr. Devon Horton has 2 decades of experience in education, according to the board. He's currently the superintendent for a school district in Illinois. DeKalb is one of the largest school districts in the state, and the board fired the last permanent superintendent a year ago and has had an interim since then. Forecasters with the National Weather Service in Peachtree City are predicting a warmer-than-usual start to the summer. Keith Stellman is the meteorologist in charge for the National Weather Service in Peachtree City. He says higher temperatures in April, May, and June could contribute to increased tornado activity.
But overall, the risk is for more tornadoes during La Nina during the spring months. Warmer than normal January, February could start the season early. And we saw that. We were record-breaking warms early January into February. And as a result, we saw pretty significant tornado activity in the southeast during those months.
Stillman says Georgia is already close to a record number of tornadoes for the year. There have been 32 counted in the state so far. The average total is 25 to 30. Forecasters have said early models predict a 60% chance of a strong El Nino weather pattern returning for the fall. El Nino typically results in colder and wetter weather during the colder months, but it's also linked to below-average hurricane activity. Truist Park will be sold out tomorrow for the Atlanta Braves home opener. They'll play the San Diego Padres for a 4-game series. First pitch is 7:20. The team's already started out pretty good so far. 4 wins and 1 loss. And the Masters gets underway tomorrow over in Augusta, Georgia. Of course, one to watch, Tiger Woods. I've seen him play many times. He's won the Masters Championship 5 times, but Woods says after a horrific 2021 accident, as for playing in the future at Augusta, he does think about how much longer.
Yes, it has. I didn't know. I mean, last year was kind of a... didn't know if I was going to play again at that time. For some reason, everything kind of came together. And I kind of pushed it a little bit, and I was able to make the cut, which was nice. And I don't know how many more I have in me. So just to be able to appreciate the time that I have here and cherish the memories.
And that audio courtesy of the Golf Channel. Woods earned his first green jacket in 1997 at the age of 21. And his latest in a career comeback at 43 in 2019. You're listening to Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at CFGreaterAtlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Now, coming up later in the program, we're going to have a segment related to the nation's opioid crisis, especially those overdoses. Now, what's important to also remember is the effect this has on children of parents who are struggling with a substance use disorder. This could mean services not only for the adults, but the children, or even the entire household. And then sometimes temporarily or permanently loss of custody. In the U.S., there are hundreds of thousands of children and youth in foster care. That's according to childwelfare.gov. And here in Georgia, the state's foster care system has over 10,000 children under the age of 18. And from those children, more than 1,300 are in permanent custody and have a primary permanency plan of adoption. But here's another challenge. Only about 4,600 are approved agency homes when it comes to foster care. And this is where other agencies and organizations are also needed. And that includes Families First. It's a longstanding organization that dates back more than 130 years ago, and they're still providing so many other services. Paula Moody was named CEO in May of last year, and she joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Rose. It is an absolute pleasure to meet you. I am a huge fan of your show, and I'm an avid listener, and thank you so much for having me here today.
And I appreciate you taking the time with us. I have covered Families First for a number of years. I believe you might be the third CEO that I've had a conversation with. And I want to begin with a little bit about what we're going to be talking about later in the program, because I feel it's tied to this increase of children and youth entering the foster care system. That is with the opioid crisis here and throughout the nation. Have you all been experiencing families needing some type of help related to this crisis?
Yeah, I do think that the opioid crisis has definitely impacted the family's abilities to function at their best. It just causes so much trauma in a family's life. As we all know, we're looking at families being separated, mostly due to neglect because of the addiction, children going into foster care, children having multiple placements, not being able to complete their education in multiple schools. And these types of really traumatic events are very impactful and unfortunately have a lasting impact on a child's life all the way into adulthood. So it's definitely something that we as nonprofit providers have to come together and have been coming together to address and really put our heads together to figure out how we can help these families and the impact on the two generations so they can really heal from the effects of the opioid crisis.
And you all have had services related for adults and for children, and particularly if there is a parent that needs some other wraparound services. Has this then also been, I don't want to use the word overwhelming, but it's added to, you know, what you all are already providing in terms of services for the entire household?
Yeah, one of our newest initiatives at Families First is our Navigator Care model, which really responds to families that have serious complex challenges. And some of these complex challenges are layered. They may start with an addiction such as an opioid crisis, and then we're looking at housing insecurity and then homelessness. And then the possibility of the family being involved in the child welfare system. And so this Navigator Care model does a great job in terms of assessing the family's needs, getting the family's input into what they need in terms of the help from Families First. And we're taking a different approach as we provide this Navigator Care model. In the past, we kind of thought about these families coming to us and Families First wonderful services, and we're going to assess them, develop a plan, and we're essentially going to fix them, and they're going to leave Families First and just do great. And now we realize that our families are going to do great while they're working with our navigators, and they're going to get the help that they need, and they're going to achieve their goals and objectives, but they're also going to have setbacks, and they're also going to have difficult times, especially as they complete the program. And so how do we focus on helping the family build their resiliency and make sure that they have the tools and the abilities to bounce back from those setbacks and those adversities once they leave Families First or any other mm-hmm. nonprofit that they're receiving services from. And our Navigator model focuses on helping families strengthen their resiliency so they can respond to those difficult times once they leave us.
And that is actually, when you talk about your impact areas, you all talk about behavioral health, parenting, and permanency programs and services. I want to back up a little bit because throughout the years, and y'all been around for a long time. You've had
132 years.
Yeah. Now, you weren't there from the beginning, obviously. But you all have had to shift as society has changed and things that come online. When you were appointed CEO, did you have a list of initiatives and priorities that you wanted to put into the strategic plan that may not necessarily weren't there, but you also wanted to maybe strengthen? What were they?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. We've been around for a long time. We just celebrated 132 years in our annual fundraising event called Loving the Legacy. That was held at the History Center, and it was a wonderful event. We had some of our supporters who've been supporting Families First for over 40 years, including our honoree Lucy Vance and our honorary chair, Ambassador Andrew Young. And it was just a wonderful event to have, to see some of our supporters and to really thank them and acknowledge them for all of their support of Families First. And because we've been around for a long time, we've had the ability to pivot and effectively respond to the community needs. And right now, our vision is that all children and families are resilient and they're able to achieve their fullest potential. Mm-hmm. And Families First vision is to become a resiliency thought leader with the adequate resources to successfully move Georgia families from surviving to thriving, as well as sharing our findings and our outcomes with other nonprofits, so we all have the tools to address the complex mm-hmm. challenges that we're seeing in many of the families that we serve.
I want to back up for our listeners who may not be familiar with how families are referred to you all. How do you get most of those folks when you first meet them, when your social workers and your counselors, mm-hmm. how do they come to Families First?
Oh, they come to Families First a number of ways. I think it helps that we've been here for 132 years. And so a lot of people do know us by name. We use social media rows. We do several outreach events in the community. As a matter of fact, we have one of our largest ones, outreach event coming up in July, our Back to School Bash, which we have nearly 2,000 people who attend that event and over 40 other community vendors, mostly nonprofits, who are able to share their information about what they're doing and the services that they're offering to the community. So our events are a big part of how we receive our referrals, as well as word of mouth. Mm-hmm. From people who have actually successfully obtained access to our referrals and then shared with other people what Families First does and recommended that they come to us for help. And our community partners, they're one of our biggest referral mm-hmm. sources. We recognize that Families First, we just can't do it all. So we're constantly referring families to other nonprofits who do the work that we don't do and vice versa.
If you're just joining us, the voice you hear is Paula Moody. She's the CEO of Families First, and we're talking about this long-standing organization here in the Atlanta area and the services they provide. And Paula, there are times when there needs to be a temporary, if not maybe even a permanent, separation from the children, the youth, and the family. I imagine that's a difficult, but what are the circumstances that, you know, that might be the case here, that is best for the child, that separation has to happen?
Yeah, I think over the years, Rose, as a community, including many of the professionals and social workers and case managers and navigators, as well as our nonprofit leaders, we really have come to understand the impact and the trauma of a child being separated from their family. and what occurs when a child is separated. So there's been a real big focus to make sure if a child has to be separated from their home, that they are, first of all, the family is offered as many resources and as many supports as possible so that child can stay in the home. And if the child is unable to stay in the home, maybe the home is just really unsafe for that child mm-hmm. to stay, and it's not the best option, then the second option is kin or fictive kin. And then if that's not an option, we've really looked at adoption and some sort of permanency versus long-term foster care or group home, where children can grow up in a family setting or close to their biological family setting as possible. And we've seen that the data around making sure that children remain in the home if possible, or with victim kid or adopted, is the best possible outcome for the child. And I think the state of Georgia, I think DFACS and all of the nonprofit providers have worked really hard around putting a plan together that makes sure that we explore that removal from the home is the last option, mm-hmm. and making sure that the families get the resources and support that they need so the family can stay intact and stay together is the first option.
And when that happens, and you have to make that decision, and we know the strain on foster care systems, not just here in Georgia, but throughout the nation, we know that there is a list, whether it's for children waiting to find a place or for just getting more foster homes online, mm-hmm. good foster homes. It's a big difference now. I want to be clear about that.
Yeah.
That is a strain for you all as well. And do you all have a wait list? We know the state does.
Yeah, the state does, and many nonprofit providers, and you're so right. You know, there is a need for good foster homes. There's many foster homes. I mean, over the years, Families First has worked with tons of foster families who've been just exceptional mm-hmm. foster families, and just going above and beyond what they're required to do as a foster family, because they really do care about these children. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there is definitely a need for more foster homes who can take larger sibling groups, as well as some of our teens, our very special teens, which, you know, they come with a history of abuse and a neglect and trauma. And it really requires a lot of patience and a lot of support to foster these teens. Mm-hmm. But we're out there working to make sure we can recruit as many foster homes as possible. I will say this, Families First has pivoted over the years. We used to be an agency that recruited and approved foster families. Mm-hmm. And we pivoted over the years to work more on the preventative side mm-hmm. and work with making sure that helping families stay out of the child welfare system. And so they don't have to go into foster care homes and the family is disrupted. Mm-hmm.
And Paula, I also want to shift to and focus on a specific population within our kids and our youth. And as the LGBTQ plus kids mm-hmm. and youth, and of course, with what just happened with the state legislature here in the last session, or do you all have services, and can you all provide services that these children and youth need?
Yeah, I think once again, our Navigator Care model and the unique services that model offers is definitely very sensitive, very welcoming and affirming to LGBTQ youth. Our staff are trained to work with LGBTQ youth and having an understanding of their unique needs. And celebrating who they are and making sure that they get services that affirms their identity. We're also very aware of other nonprofits who work with LGBTQ youth, and we mm-hmm. partner with them. Nonprofits such as Sir Familia.
Just had a conversation with them. Yeah.
Yeah. An awesome agency. And we just make sure that we are aware of all of the resources for LGBTQ youth and constantly connecting them to those resources and making sure that they feel safe and affirmed within our programs and services.
I want to shift for a moment and talk about your leadership now in this new role. It's a bit different when you also have to go out and get the money and also give folks to continue giving. What have you yes. learned so far? Not quite a year yet, but you're coming upon it. What's been your takeaway so far as CEO?
Oh, my takeaway so far. Well, you know what, Rose, I started at Families First as one of our directors. Mm-hmm. And so this is my 10th, I'm actually going into my 10th year at Families First. So I'm very familiar with the programs and the history and what we've been doing at Families First and where we're heading at Families First. We also have a very supporting the board of directors who is really committed to our 132-year history and the future direction of Families First. So I have to say it is an absolute honor to be the CEO of this organization. I often say to anyone who talks to me, Families First has some of the best staff who work here, who are just really qualified and dedicated and committed to the families that we serve and just do a great job, because this work is not easy. And as you know, Rose, we don't get paid a lot of money. So it's really about our commitment to these families, commitment to the community, and just a commitment to making sure people have the resources and support to move forward.
But in this, I guess, current state of what we call modern philanthropy, and look, I work for a nonprofit, so I understand, because twice a year, three times a year, we send out, you know, mugs and socks and ask people to support our mission. And we appreciate your support. By the way, get ready. It's coming up soon. So I definitely understand that. But when we talk about this current state of modern philanthropy, are there some trends that you like and then some trends that you would like to see maybe go away? Or is it really just about telling your story and making sure that folks feel that their investment in your organization is you all are doing what you're supposed to be doing?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think a lot of it is that when you have a mission that resonates with family, with people and the community, and it responds to the needs of the community, I definitely think it is much easier to raise the funds that you need that supports the work that we do, which I feel that Families First does. I also believe that, you know, it is very difficult sometimes to raise money for the work that we're doing. But I think that if your work is backed by data and outcomes and you can prove that what you are doing really does work, I think that helps in terms of raising the money and the support that you need to continue your services and to execute your mission.
And how often do you all, when you tell this story, that you bring in families? But that you do it in a way that, and listen, I've had this conversation before, that you do it in a way that it is also showing dignity for the household or for the folks that you help, and that people are hearing an authentic, you know, story. How often do you need to bring folks in to tell your story?
All the time. I mean, we want to make sure that everyone who needs assistance knows about us, knows how to access us, knows what we're offering, knows how to make it very easier, break down the barriers to receive our services. And that requires us to get out there and make sure people know about what Families First is doing, how impactful we are in the community. And it's something that we understand we have to do, and it's something that is needed, and it's something that we enjoy doing. You know, we're never shy about telling the world about what we do here at Families First.
And finally, Paul, as you wrap up, you've devoted most of your professional career to working with children, youth, and family services. Why do you do this work?
Oh, wow. That is a great question. Rose, I think I was put on this earth to do this work. I started off After graduating, I'm a graduate from proud graduate from HBCU, North Carolina A&T.
All right.
And right after graduating from college and my first master's degree, I got a job at a group home working with adolescent teens. And I knew right then that that was my calling, that I always wanted to work with teens. I always wanted to work in a nonprofit. It just felt comfortable. It felt like that's what I was born to do. And when I got my second master's as a master's of social work, I knew that I wanted to be in nonprofit leadership. It's something that just comes really natural to me. And I just, it doesn't even feel like work. I really, really, truly enjoy this work. And it keeps me going every day. And I'm just so fortunate to be able to help the families that we serve, work for families first, and really make an impact on our community.
All right. And listen, for folks out there who may have some perceptions about kids in foster homes, you've been listening to one now for about, almost 30 years. Paula Moody, the CEO of Families First, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Rose.
And thank you for what you all are doing to help so many households, too. And Closer Look continues now from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. A programming note, this next audio piece contains descriptions of a drug overdose.
The opioid overdose crisis killed more than 100,000 Americans for the most recent year on record, the most ever. It's being called one of the most pressing national security and public health challenges facing the U.S. And these overdoses are costing the nation an estimated $1 trillion a year.
A majority of those overdoses are being driven by the highly potent synthetic opioid fentanyl. Manufactured abroad and trafficked into the U.S., it's then sold by itself or mixed into various street drugs or counterfeit pharmaceuticals, where its potency often turns deadly.
Michaela. Dude. What is this?
We're seeing more and more prescription medications and opioid-based narcotics affect our community. A large number of overdoses. Our officers are using Narcan to save people's lives on a weekly basis. I firmly believe there's not a street that we could drive up and down that someone on that street doesn't have a connection to this current ongoing problem.
You know, nobody prepares you for what to do when your child's struggling with addiction.
When people are little kids, they do not sit and say, I want to grow up to be an alcoholic or an addict. They don't. People never know when it's going to hit them. A lot of times they find out with that first hit that they take.
You know, right now the most important thing is for the community to be aware that this is out there and is a risk to their health, that is potentially lethal.
In just 48 hours, a dangerous drug has swept through Middle Georgia, taking the lives of four people.
We have had more than a dozen cases of opioid overdose appear in the emergency rooms of both Navicent, the Houston Healthcare ER, and Coliseum Medical Center.
And news reports there from PBS NewsHour. From the documentary 7 Days, The Opioid Crisis in Arkansas, that's courtesy of Arkansas PBS, and then from the Macon, Georgia TV station 41 NBC, and their report from a few years ago, Opioid Overdoses in Middle Georgia. Since 2000, more than a million people in the U.S. have died of drug overdoses, the majority of which were due to opioids. And according to the most recent data from the CDC, about 2,500 people died in Georgia from a drug overdose between October 2021 and October 2022. And if you want even some other numbers, it's estimated more than 1,500 people per week die from an opioid-related overdose. And while national average, they may show a decline in overdoses, the CDC does cite that Georgia cases are rising, and especially among, states in the Southeast. Perhaps in an attempt to save more lives, now the FDA just approved Narcan for over-the-counter use. Joining me now to talk more about this and why this is so important is Navigate Recovery. They're based in Gwinnett County, and the organization is already distributing Narcan, and you'll hear how in just a moment. I want to welcome in Farley Barge, the co-founder and president, and Ashley Parham, the Lifeline Lead Recovery Coach and Program Implementation Specialist. Thank you both for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Rez.
You know, coming into this segment, and we played those news clips, and Farley, I'll start with you. None of that was new. None of that was lost on you, what was said. And again, there was a description of someone that had overdosed as a friend found them in a car. You heard that. Your thoughts?
Well, Rose, it breaks my heart every time I hear these stories, and I hear news of somebody in our community, in our state, that's passed from another opioid overdose. Mm-hmm. We've been hearing this now for far too long as an organization, but as a person in recovery myself, it has a special meaning to me. Mm-hmm. Because so many of our young people are being affected, and we're losing them in record numbers. And I'm a father of five daughters. So it feels like it's personal to me whenever mm-hmm. it happens. And so it just really breaks my heart that we're experiencing this as a country. Mm-hmm. Something that's preventable, mm-hmm. by the way. So it's devastating, I believe, to myself and certainly the families that are directly affected. We're blessed that we haven't been directly affected. Now we've had addiction and mm-hmm. some mental health issues in our family, but we haven't lost anybody. Mm-hmm. But it's just by God's grace that happens.
Ashley, your thoughts?
I got teary-eyed listening to that, those clips. I'm actually from Macon. That's where I was raised. And I've been to countless funerals of friends that have passed away due to an overdose. My most recent loss was August of 2022. My yeah. best friend passed away from an accidental overdose when she didn't have the opportunity to be saved by Narcan.
Mm. Ashley, our condolences on your friend. It's okay. It's okay. You take as much time as you need, and our condolences on the passing of your friend. I'm going to go to Farley for a second, and we'll come back to you. Did it take the FDA too long to finally authorize this, or does it even really matter now to have this discussion that it is approved for over-the-counter sales?
Well, again, very, very close to the heart on this one, because first off, I'm thankful that they took the action. Yes, it would have been great if we could have done it much, much sooner. Mm-hmm. But you got to remember that this is not the first opioid crisis that we've faced. In fact, I would argue that this opioid crisis, the fentanyl one, is a direct result of the previous one that we faced, where people became addicted to prescription opioids at the recommendation of their doctors in the vast majority of the cases. And then we made changes to the way that those particular drugs were distributed and some of the mechanics of how they were manufactured. And we cut a lot of people off. So we created a whole generation of people addicted to opioids. And then we told them, oh, I'm sorry, you can't get that anymore. And we didn't provide any sort of intermediary treatment or we didn't have a plan for one. And so now the folks that are out there peddling fentanyl today, they're just opportunists. They're just taking advantage of something that we've already created, and they're capitalizing on it. Unfortunately, those people that have become addicted to opioids are the casualties in this situation and the collateral damage, if you will.
Ashley, I can give you some more moments. It's okay. We have time.
Oh, no, I'm fine. Okay. And Farley made some good points. I'm actually one of those people that was, my addiction started with a prescription after an accident. And I didn't know what I was dancing with. I didn't know what it would lead me down, what path. So I'm grateful that I found recovery, and I've been in recovery for a little over 7 years now. And I am grateful that I'm able to sit bedside with people that are in the hospital mm-hmm. from overdose or withdrawal situations, talking about the options of recovery that they have now today.
And obviously, in order to get to that process of recovery, we want folks to simply be alive, and that's where the Narcan comes in. And so, Ashley, I'll stay with you. For listeners who may not be familiar with what this actually does, can you tell them about it?
Yes. So when someone has taken too many opiates for their system, we have opiate receptors all through our nervous system, from our brainstem all the way down to our spinal cord. And opiates attach to these receptors. And especially in the brainstem, it slows breathing. Mm-hmm. And to the point where someone can stop breathing altogether. So what Narcan does, it's the medication that goes into the system, attaches itself to those receptors, knocks off the opioids mm-hmm. in order for the person that is in overdose state to start regaining their respiratory function again mm-hmm. and come back to consciousness.
And this is administered how?
So there are a couple of ways of administration. There is the nasal Narcan, which we train and distribute for free here at Navigate Recovery Gwinnett. There is an intramuscular, where it uses a syringe and a vial of Narcan. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the IV Narcan, which that is for medical personnel use, such mm-hmm. as EMTs, nurses, and of that situation.
Farley, I want to come back to you because there have been some, not necessarily criticism, but concerns that if you have this over the counter, that it doesn't, it might encourage, and you have, and whether the age group is 18 or 88, that folks then will rely on this, and that may not actually help reduce in terms of the usage of the opioids. And what do you say to those folks who have those concerns?
Well, you said it earlier. If you're not alive, we can't help you. It's just that simple. If people, we wouldn't treat someone that had diabetes and had fallen into a diabetic coma because they ate too much cake. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't not treat them, would we? Mm-hmm. So, and we would not make medications available to them, would we? I mean, there's no difference. This is a medical condition. Mm-hmm. It's something that people are struggling with. We don't have enough resources to help them overcome that condition mm-hmm. or to even learn about how to treat, what treatment looks like. So, and much less the families and the loved ones that are also affected. So I think it's a bit of a naive comment to say that that is going to somehow perpetuate the problem. Mm-hmm. Maybe in a small number, but it also does something else that's really significant. And that's that there's still a lot of shame and stigma associated mm-hmm. With addiction,
yeah,
any kind of addiction. But in this particular case, people are afraid to go to the pharmacy, for instance, which they've been able to do for the last 2 years, go to the pharmacy and get a script from the pharmacist to get the Narcan. Mm-hmm. But there's still that stigma associated with it. Now we're going to put something on the counter that they can pay for mm-hmm. and they can purchase, and they can keep it in their home. They can keep it in their car. They can take it with them. So they always have it available. It's kind of like the EpiPen, you know, if we took away the EpiPen, you know what we'd have? We'd have a lot of people dying from diabetes.
And in some instances, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was going to be my next correlation, because I've done stories where districts have had to, you know, their concern was, how do I pay for this? Now, if you don't know what the cost of it, let me tell you something. An EpiPen is very costly. So when we talk about having Narcan, you all have been doing this because you have these vending machines.
Yes, yes. That the vending machine is a relatively new idea. We try to be innovative. We try to get things out into the community in ways that maybe haven't been thought about before. Mm-hmm. In this case, it has been thought about before. It's actually been practiced by some of our neighboring states up in the Northeast, the closest being in North Carolina, and it's been effective there. So we know that it's a good way to get the anecdote out into the community, mm-hmm. and in particular in our little part of the state in Gwinnett County, which is the most diverse county in the state, we know where the areas are that that the EMS and others tend to get the most calls from, because we have a very close partnership with our health department. Mm-hmm. And so we know that we can target those areas by providing these vending machines that distribute the Narcan to that population that needs it the most.
Actually, have you had conversations with folks who said, listen, this vending machine, we knew where it was, we need it, and it saved someone's life? Have you had that conversation with folks?
I've had conversations with people that I've trained, because we offer and we've been offering Narcan trainings and distribution at no cost for quite a while now, previously from implementing the vending machine. And my mother was one person I trained, and she was actually able to train her neighbor who saved her son. Mm. So it's all about community and connection with other individuals. I believe that whether you have addiction in your past, you know someone that's been affected by addiction, or even if you haven't, I think everyone should be trained and carry Narcan no matter what circles you move in, because you never know what's going to come in front of you at any given time in your day-to-day life.
Do you all, and I know that we touched on this a little bit, but if we could take it further, when you think about the impact that now having Narcan available over the counter, you all talked about areas in your community where you know it is probably greatly needed. How optimistic are you that now we're making some greater strides in dealing with this opioid overdose crisis here in America? Ashley?
I believe that we are better now than we were previously, but we have a long way to go. Mm-hmm. I think that my colleagues and the people in recovery that live their recovery out loud are helping to reduce and change the way that we're viewed as people in recovery, and the way people that have a substance use disorder and alcoholism are viewed. It's not a moral failing. It's not because we're bad people. It is simply the fact that addiction does not discriminate. There's no, you know, prerequisite of why this person, why I'm someone that has addiction and is now in sustained long-term recovery, and my brother is completely, has no effects of alcoholism or addiction in his story. Mm-hmm. We same mother, same father, 2.5 years apart, same upbringing. I am affected. He is not. I'm beyond ecstatic that he is not. But there's no things that I did that made it to where I was the one that was affected by addiction. Of course, my whole family was affected by my addiction. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that we make great strides to do here, is support the family and the friends of those that are in addiction and all those beginning their recovery journey, because addiction is a family disease. Mm-hmm. It's not just my problem. What I was doing and the things that I was going through was affecting my family and my friends greater than I was realizing.
Farley, I'm going to ask you a different question, because often when we have these crises, and we have a lot of them, we have a lot going on in the United States, and we're not the only ones, but it's often the organizations and agencies. I just had a conversation with Families First. It's often organizations like you all that are on the front line, as we call it, working directly with people. I think I know the answer to this when I ask, you know, you all could use more resources as well.
Well, always, yeah. Always. yes, there aren't enough resources. And I think that probably I see the biggest barrier right now is the lack of education and knowledge about really what addiction is in our community. If here's what I say, Rose, all the time, mm-hmm. you know, we saw that with COVID, that when we have resolved to work through a problem, a crisis like that, that we can bring anything to bear that we need in order to try to work our way through that. I think this country did an exemplary effort in the way we dealt with COVID. It wasn't all successful every day, but overall, when you look at the amount of energy, effort, dollars that were spent, and we came up with a shot, you know, we came up with something, you know, in a record time, that helped people not die. If we brought a tenth of that effort, attention to this crisis, and it is a crisis, it's a huge crisis. If we brought a tenth of that effort, surely we can make a difference. We could turn the dial. But as much as I'd love to say that Navigate Recovery is the be-all, end-all, we're not. We're just one small organization in a larger sea of organizations. Mm-hmm. And there's several other organizations around the state that are doing similar work. Mm-hmm. We're part of a small network of about 26 some odd organizations across this state that are doing similar work.
Farley, I have a listener who has a question, wants to know where can they find where these vending machines with Narcan, where they're located in Gwinnett County. Is that on your website?
We have a vending machine here at our offices, 52 Gwinnett Drive. Mm-hmm. We are working with our partners at the health department who are in process of making a plan for how they want to distribute them. We were really waiting for this FDA approval of over-the-counter Narcan to hit. And so we're in dialogue with them constantly about that, but I don't have the locations yet. Mm-hmm. As I said, we have one here. And of course, we provide Narcan training. Ashley's one of our trainers. We have several here. The truth is you can walk in the door here anytime and get trained on Narcan. And by the way, you don't have to come here. If you got a small group or an organization, you want us to go where you are, we'll go where you are. We'll train you on Narcan. We've done, Ashley can tell you, she's trained many, many people.
We've done 200 trainings in person year to date from January 1st till now, April 5th.
We'll put that information on our website as well. Ashley Parham, the Lifeline Lead Recovery Coach and Program Implementation Specialist, and Farley Barge, the co-founder and president. Thank you all so much with the work that you're doing at Navigate Recovery. Thank you.
Thank you for having
us. Having us. Yes, thank you, Rose.
And that's it for this edition of Closer Look. Our producers are LaShawn Hudson and Daniel Raizel. Tiffany Griffith is our supervising producer. Our engineer is Sawyer Vanderwerth. A reminder to let us know your thoughts on today's program or any other, send that email, rose@wabe.org. And if you missed any of today's program, it's online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, Closer Look weeknights at 7 p.m., as well as our podcast. So subscribe to Closer Look where you like. I have a lot of emails from you all, so we will again have that information from Navigate Recovery on our website as soon as we can. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now plugged in, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.